23. I'll ask the marshal to introduce the panel, please.
Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Ross, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
And welcome again. And we will ask counsel to repeat their names now that we're recording when you begin your arguments and whom you represent. We are in the Zoom format, but do both counsel see the clock in the corner of their or somewhere in their screen?
Yes, Your
Honor. Okay, and thank you. If for any reason we lose connection, audio or visual, most importantly audio, I suspect the marshal knows to stop the clock until we are able to resume. We do record these proceedings and they are available on the Judicial Branch's website within 24 hours, so any other recording is prohibited. And I'll note for the record our first of three oral arguments that we have today, which will be followed by three non-oral matters we'll also consider, is file A20-20035, Robert Sherrod, appellant versus Water Gremlin Company as respondent. And so counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Laura Sheets on behalf of the appellant plaintiff. Okay, if I may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
You indeed will be granted 5 minutes. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And forgive me, at least when you were speaking, my connection was a little bit spotty, so I presume you'll let me know if something that I'm saying doesn't come across clearly. I won't sit here and regurgitate all the facts or the law, I think, that we laid out in our papers before the court. I'm sure the court has gone over them in great detail, and I'm assuming has questions of me that I would be happy to answer. But I do think that there are some points that I would like to go over and really emphasize, as I think they pretty much highlight why we're here today and why we firmly believe that the lower court ruling should be overturned and we should be allowed to go back to the trial court and begin the process of engaging in discovery, not only on behalf of Mr. Sherrod, but also on behalf of the proposed class that we outlined in our, again, putative class complaint. So as you know, and again, not to belabor the record here, but
Ms. Sheets, before you go on, you made a point about discovery and you raised a comment in your brief regarding that as well. And is it true that your client did not formally object or raise that issue when the court in the first order set a 90-day discovery limit for the first two counts that were not dismissed? The question I'm asking is, seems like it's not properly before as that particular issue because it wasn't raised below.
And Your Honor, I would disagree. I think that we were on the record as noting, quite honestly, several times throughout the process, we had a couple of hearings. We had a hearing initially before the trial court gave us the 90 days where he indicated he was going to do that. And we voiced objection to that at the time. I want to say we also did so at the oral argument when we started the hearing after having had the 90 days. But there were also a couple, and I'm not entirely certain that they're a part of the record per se, but most definitely where we had conversations about in the process of us producing what is and was a very voluminous expert report in 90 days. There was quite a bit of back and forth about the fact that we should be producing the expert report in advance of the defendant filing their motion for summary judgment. And all along that process, we voiced those objections about how difficult this was to basically compile anything within that time frame, much less evidence establishing Mr. Sherrod's injuries and damages. And that kind of goes along with the theme here, which is essentially too what the court had instructed us to do was to focus just on our named plaintiff and somewhat ignore the class allegations that were made in the complaint. As you know, we have alleged that the defendant's conduct, which again, we believe is affirmatively a part of the record establishing that their emissions were spewed over an area of about 1.5 to 1.8 miles, affecting about 5,500 individuals within that area. What we alleged was the negligence and the nuisance that Mr. Sherritt had in fact suffered property damage and had been deprived of the use or enjoyment of his property. When the court gave us 90 days to essentially prove again injuries and damages, what we started looking at in hiring a diminution expert was the entire class area, not because we were ignoring the court's strict admonition that we stick solely to the named plaintiff, but because in order to prove what we were hoping to prove and eventually did prove that Mr. Sherritt's property had been negatively impacted, it was necessary for Mr. Anderson and his firm to look at the class as a whole. It wasn't something that you could just look at Mr. Sherritt's property and appraise it before and appraise it after, and then try to draw some nexus to what the defendant had in fact done. We had to show that because of the stigma of the documented conduct by this defendant, that that had in fact impacted the entire area of which Mr. Sherritt belongs.
Ms. Sheets, on the issue of stigma, yes. The judge during the summary judgment hearing asked you, I think you were giving the argument too at the district court level, why a soil contamination test had not been taken. And your response was that this particular substance would have gone away by the time you take a test. And so then the judge followed up. So is your sole basis at this point stigma, which is the diminution in value that you're now just referring to? Would it be accurate to say that your client abandoned a actual invasion of property contamination based on that response, and it's solely on a stigma claim of damage?
No, Your Honor. And I think that's a great question. And unfortunately, I think some of the terminology that the parties were talking about in terms of, you know, what had actually occurred and the difference between stigma damages and stigma and actual contamination, that some of that verbiage may have gotten somewhat commingled. But our primary claim in our 51-page complaint, and it has been and always will be, that this contaminant was in fact present on Mr. Sherritt's property. The evidence by an independent third party, that being the state agency, establishes that that TCE on some levels was at some point on his property. The argument becomes what level of that constitutes contamination, but we went into proving in this 90 days our injuries and our damages that evidence was enough to get us past summary judgment because it was independent evidence. You can't test the soil, but what we would in fact do had we survived this 90-day requirement was we would hire our own air modeler who would look at the data, look at the outputs from what this facility was pumping into the air, and look at the air dispersion modeling and have our own modeling done to establish the fate and transport of what they were doing over time to confirm the existence of this TCE on his property. Where unfortunately things sort of got commingled and confusing throughout the process was that Mr. Sherritt's home, more than a year after this initial news broke, after the massive publicity that was going on, notifying not only Mr. Sherritt, but the entire community in the bigger state of Minnesota of what was going on, his home was squarely within that area of concern. A year later, they moved that area of concern based on using a different source point for the modeling, at which point Mr. Sherritt's home then became a tenth of a mile outside this area of concern. But at no point does that say that that means his home was excluded from getting a TCE on it. What it says is that that different model showed that he may not have gotten the TCE in a level that was bad for his health, that met that certain sort of health benchmark that the state was looking at. It does not say that he did not get TCE on his property. So the very long-winded way of answering your question, I hope, is to Absolutely not. You, in fact, believe that we can prove that that content was on his property during the relative period of time here. But we also are saying, if in fact that wasn't the case, given the 90 days, if the court had found that we hadn't been able to prove that, which we felt that we had at least met that summary judgment standard that had been flipped on its head and put in our lap, that we certainly could still say there was plenty of case law out there supporting that, even without the presence of the TC on his property, that you could in fact have a pure stigma claim in Minnesota. But we're not abandoning the fact that we believe that content was on his property.
Ms. Sheets, you made reference to the judge flipping the burden, and I saw that in your brief, and I'm a little unsure. I understand your basis for that. The judge considered, obviously, the evidence that the moving party presented, and though that's to be considered in favor of the non-moving party, if there's disputes, the point they made really is a lack of evidence. And obviously your client cannot rely in response on the averments in a complaint. So the judge seemed to focus, and I understood that's why the judge was asking, well, was there a test taken on the property to show an actual genuine issue material fact that there has been an invasion on your client's property of the contaminant. And so I'm not sure I understand when you say flipping the burden, would you agree that as a matter of law in responding to summary judgment, your client would have to do more than repeat the allegations in the complaint, but would have to show evidence that there's actually been an invasion on the property for either the negligence and or the nuisance claim? And absent a test, there's no evidence to so indicate that.
I agree with the first part of your statement up until the last part, Your Honor, which I do think that, again, there's nothing that's establishing that we have to have soil testing to establish that this contaminant was on his property. It's our position that the independent third-party modeling that was done establishes that this chemical was, in fact, on his property during the entirety, the 15 years, is in fact a chemical in exceedance of tons of its permit per year onto this man's property. So our focus, really, we felt that content and that evidence would carry us as to that component. And what we focused on were proving, which were his damages, in fact, that he could establish not just alleged diminution, but that we could in fact establish it. And so we set out to do just that. And honestly, it's a roll of the dice as to whether or not the numbers were going to say what we had basically were alleging, and they did in fact do that. So what I meant by flipping it on its head, it just seemed, especially given the 90-day window, that instead of giving every inference or every doubt in our favor, that it was essentially put in our lap to prove our case. And while we were successful in getting the diminution analysis done, it would have been impossible to have gone and gotten our own independent air modeling to establish what the state had already affirmed, which is that this chemical had in fact been present on his property during the relevant time period in which it was being emitted. So we did not feel that we were giving any sort of inferences to our favor. And quite honestly, in terms of the defendant saying we didn't have any evidence, it's actually them who didn't have any evidence at all. They quibble about which modeling was correct, the initial modeling that put him in the area of concern or the subsequent modeling. But that's really not the issue. Either way, his home was still directly in the line of fire of these chemicals. And air modeling was in fact used by the state to establish the fate and transport of these chemicals, not soil testing.
Ms. Sheets, can I have you jump to the issue of the stigma damage claim that your client has alleged? Was the district court correct? And am I correct in reading your brief that you have been able to find no law in Minnesota that provides for a stigma damage other than in a tort case? So in other words, the cases you've cited are all tax valuation issues or eminent domain, but there's no law that we could look at to conclude that a stigma damage has ever previously been accepted in a tort proceeding in Minnesota.
That is correct. But again, that is a what we would call a pure stigma claim, absent of any contamination or any sort of encroachment. That those cases, and really the kind of outlying thing is basically if there isn't contamination, there's threatened contamination, or you're near the contamination, is that pure stigma claim ever been addressed in Minnesota law? No, it hasn't. But I do think that what we've supplied the court with, that it provides more than enough evidence that Minnesota is in fact one of the areas and one of the jurisdictions that would view the fact that he did have a contaminant on his property coupled with a depreciation of value, sufficient enough to withstand a summary judgment motion. So if I could I reserve my 41 seconds? Is that okay? Or
well, yeah, you'll only get 5 minutes. So if there's any final 30-second comments you want to make, you may do so.
No, other than to say again, I guess coming full circle here, that, there's no doubt. I don't think that they can accurately or adequately dispute the fact that this chemical was spread throughout the neighborhood. And so we established with this expert report that I think would survive any sort of challenge on their part, that there was in fact a diminution of value here based on your location or your proximity to this facility. And we'd like to conduct discovery to flush out the rest of our claim.
Very well, thank you.
Thank you.
And you're thank welcome. You. And you will have 5 minutes rebuttal and counsel for responding. You may identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Ben Kappelman for FLE Water Gremlin. Appellant's theory of this case has always alleged wide-ranging wrongdoing by Water Gremlin impacting a large area.
I'm sorry, Mr. Kappelman, I'm going to interrupt you. I'm going to ask the marshal to, and I may have confused, to put the full 15 minutes for respondent. Very good. Very now. You may continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge. So in appellant's view, this case has always been about the whole neighborhood, the whole class area, the whole city. And the problem with that is he individually has a claim. This issue of appellant needing to show that his property was contaminated as a means of showing that he has an individual injury that he can assert a claim for has never been a surprise. That was a primary theory of Water Gremlin's motion to dismiss, and it was exactly why the district court in its decision on that motion expressed skepticism, as the court put it, that appellant could move his claims forward. The district court dismissed appellant's statutory claims, allowed his tort claims to proceed, but said in that motion to dismiss decision, quote, Sherritt must somehow prove that his property was in fact invaded by TCE and that the TCE on his property is that which was released from the Water Gremlin plant into White Bear Township. Now, as it turned out in discovery, the district court's skepticism was well-founded because indeed, appellant was unable to show that there was any contamination of his property. Now, we were discussing earlier the issue of the discovery period and the timing, and I believe counsel for appellant's recollection is mistaken in that appellant did not object to the discovery period when that discovery was occurring. In fact, just the opposite. There was a dispute involving when appellant was going to produce his expert report that the court has heard about today. There were some letters back and forth. And one of those letters from appellant to the district court, written on July 19th, 2021, about 2/3 of the way through the discovery period, says, quote, counsel for plaintiff has not sought an extension of any of this court's deadlines and has no intention of doing so. When Water Gremlin was objecting to appellant's production of an expert report on the very last day of that 90-day discovery period, appellant used the end of that discovery as a sword and has continued to make arguments that Water Gremlin had some sort of burden to rebut that expert report. And that is exactly why appellant cannot now claim that the discovery period was inadequate, particularly because the district court told appellant exactly what the court was going to be looking for in that summary judgment hearing that the court set for the end of the 90-day discovery period. I want to talk about the MPCA's area of concern because we've heard some discussion of that this morning. As the court is aware, there are two maps showing an area of concern in 2019 and a revised area of concern in 2020. Now, counsel for appellant has described the 2019 map as placing appellant's property squarely within of the area of concern. And I would dispute that, Your Honors. Even in the 2019 version of the area of concern, appellant's property is barely within that area originally identified by the MPCA. And critically, that map was revised. The MPCA used new weather data, which it stated was thought to better represent weather conditions around Water Gremlin. And the revised area of concern does not include appellant's property.
So just on that point, why doesn't that create a fact dispute? You've got two different models. Are you saying that it's implausible for a fact finder to believe that the 2019 model was actually more accurate than the 2020 model, despite the revision?
Yes,
and why is that not a fact dispute? I guess that's my question.
Well, there are two reasons. One, it's the same source. So this would be akin to if an expert hired for litigation recants that expert's testimony, and then the party proffering that expert wants to go back and put the old expert report in front of the jury and say, hey, this expert used to think this other thing that's favorable.
Well, I don't know if that's actually correct. I mean, it's one thing that, you've got an actual study in this case. I mean, it's a model. It seems different for me than a recantation if you just simply reallocate the analysis and come to a different conclusion. It seems to me, at least arguably, that a fact finder might believe that the first model was more accurate than the second model. I'm curious why that's not necessarily so.
Well, because the MPCA went further than just publishing a second model. They withdrew the first one. And that was a point that we made to the district court that, as far as we could tell, the only publicly available map of the 2019 area of concern was the one that was put into the record in this litigation. That was not something that the MPCA had up on its website available for the public to look at after the 2020 area issued. More importantly, and I think this is critical, it wouldn't be a dispositive fact issue even if it was, because the mere presence in the area of concern is not sufficient evidence to show that appellants or any other property was contaminated. That area of concern is a map of exposure.
It would show invasion, not maybe ongoing contamination, but you would agree that it would show, if the 2019 study is accurate, it would show at least evidence of invasion. Would you agree with that?
It would be evidence suggesting that exposure may have occurred. And the problem with that, Your Honor, is that that's not sufficient to support the property damage claims that appellant is advancing in this case. He disavowed in the complaint any kind of personal injury claim. And so the only question before this court is whether he can proceed on negligence and nuisance claims alleging injury to his property. And as we've explained in the briefs, mere presence within the area of concern is not sufficient to show that a property was in fact injured in a way that creates a cognizable claim. And on that point, appellant doesn't cite any case law.
By the way, you're suggesting that even if there's evidence of opinion testimony, which might be refuted by other experts, but opinion testimony supporting the idea of a diminution in value?
That's correct, because that still doesn't, like the testimony that appellant proffered through the expert he did retain, who produced a report that was hundreds of pages long. There was lots of analysis in it. They just chose to focus that analysis on diminution of property value alone, and not whether anything in the record indicated that Mr. Sherritt's or any other property was in fact contaminated by TCE. So to that point, appellant doesn't cite any case law that supports the idea that you can bring a property damage tort claim in Minnesota merely because a particulate matter that you were unaware of at the time may have passed into your property. And appellant makes the point that he didn't consent to the presence of any contaminant on his property at any point. And the problem with that is it feels like appellant is trying to get around the rule in the Johnson v. Painesville case that Minnesota does not recognize a cause of action for trespass based purely on particulate matter. He has a negligence claim and a nuisance claim, And both of those claims require that he show some sort of injury to his property and not just a mere invasion, as would be more in line with a trespass theory. Your Honors, I also want to touch on the pure stigma problem. The vast majority of jurisdictions that have addressed this issue have held that there is no tort claim based on pure stigma, that is, a diminution in property value based on the correct or otherwise perception that a property that is not contaminated might be contaminated. This court would be the first in Minnesota to recognize that tort theory. And as we've explained in the brief, it is more appropriate for the legislature to be creating new causes of action and new court claims than it is this court. The appellant brought statutory claims under MRLA in his complaint, and the district court dismissed those statutory claims, and that dismissal was not appealed. And so the appellant has already had the opportunity to invoke the statutory remedies that the Minnesota legislature has seen fit to provide for in this context, and those claims were not successful. His attempt to push this into a tort context that has not been recognized in Minnesota or in many other places, it should be rejected. Although there are no Minnesota courts that have addressed this issue, there is the Delaware Bankruptcy Court and the W.R. Grace case, which addressed Minnesota law and predicted in 2006 that the Minnesota courts would not recognize a pure stigma claim in the context of environmental contamination. And I know the court is familiar
with that. Mr. Kaplan, yes. Can I ask you about that? Explain to me why you think it would be a significant leap from the tax and eminent domain cases, where obviously our Supreme Court has recognized the existence of a stigma stigma damage to the valuation of property. Why, from a public policy standpoint, would that be an improper leap for us in a tort arena, given we're talking with real property as well as they do in tax law, and they recognize that? And I'm assuming that your client, I didn't see that your client's necessarily here disputing, at least at this stage, the very reasonable presumption that, given the publicity, that house sales and so forth, the values have gone down in that region, including the appellants.
So to answer that, why would the Supreme Court recognize in those contexts? And I think the answer is because the legislature said that it should. And there are statutory bases for recognizing stigma in those contexts that are not present here. And for some good reasons, in a tax context or in an eminent domain context, a value of a property has to be determined at a particular moment in time. And one of the policy problems with recognizing pure stigma claims in the tort context is that it is amorphous as to when the valuation date for a particular property should be when there's a stigma claim. And appellant is a really good example of that, because he conceded in discovery that he has made no efforts to sell his property, to refinance his property, to do anything where a decreased property value would have any monetary effect on him. And so that's one of the policy reasons that courts across the country cite when they are rejecting this type of claim, is this can provide windfall recoveries to property owners who are allowed to make a pure stigma claim, but then can simultaneously wait until that stigma is no longer present and then sell their property. There are other policy reasons that I know the court has seen in the case law that we've cited. The federal court in the Mercer case looked at a lot of case law and highlighted how courts require physical damage to property in the first instance because they don't want to allow those windfall recoveries from normal fluctuations in property value. The Michigan Supreme Court in the Atkins case highlighted those fluctuations and then reached the conclusion that this court should reach, which is that the legislature should decide if it wants to recognize some sort of pure stigma claim, and if it does, what sort of principles should guide the courts when they decide what compensation is due to someone making a tort claim. The Atkins case also highlights other policy problems, like permitting pure stigma claims, allowing property owners to sue their neighbor in tort when they don't like how their neighbor's land is being used, which is not something, unless it creates a nuisance, that courts recognize. And we look at, we've cited cases about adjacent funeral homes or property owners doing something that obstructs the sight lines from a neighboring property.
The other, I mean, those are easily distinguished circumstances from the allegations here, correct? I mean, here we're talking about an invasion. We're not, that's the allegation. It's not just some concern about the activity that goes on other property that does not have any direct invasion or influence on a plaintiff's property.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with that, and I would highlight the nuisance statute itself does not permit nuisance claims in all cases. You first have to have a nuisance, which the statute defines as something which is injurious to health or indecent or offensive to the senses or an obstruction to the free use of property. And when you have a tort plaintiff in appellant's position and there is no evidence that anything affected their property, was injurious to health, because again, we're not in a personal injury context here, and you're talking about a pure stigma claim of the type that courts across the country have rejected, it creates the exact same policy issues in permitting tort plaintiffs to challenge a neighbor's use of their property in a nuisance claim without showing that it is affecting the plaintiff's property interest, one of the bedrock requirements of bringing a nuisance claim in the state of Minnesota. I want to turn briefly to another aspect of the plaintiff's nuisance claim, which is the district court's decision that there was insufficient evidence that appellant's voluntary changes in the way that he used his property were consistent with the reasonable and ordinary expectations of a member of the community. And the problem that appellant has created attempting to uncouple and remove the nexus between the existence of a nuisance and the way that it impacted him. Because in the very first media report, when appellant learned of the emission of TCE in the past, he also learned from the MPCA that TCE had not collected in the area and it did not present a public health risk. And for those reasons, Your Honors, we respectfully ask that the court affirm the decision below.
Very well, thank you. And counsel for appellant, you will now have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You may proceed.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I'd first like to, if I could, direct the court at some point to revisit page 15 of our brief, which talks about the 2020 area of concern and the modeling that was done. And the quote that we pulled out from the state agency talks about how, again, this is the 2020 area of concern. The map underestimates TCE air concentrations. It also goes on to say the TCE air concentrations extend beyond the outlined area shown in the maps. So there's, just because Mr. Sherrod's property, again, was moved a tenth of a mile, we hold steadfast to our belief and our claim that we would be able to establish and have established for purposes of summary judgment that that content and that chemical was in fact pumped onto his property for 15 years. And I would just say too that, you know, going to your question about, is it a leap for this court to look at the claims presented here outside of the context from the case law that we've provided in tax disputes. And no, I do not think that it is a leap for this court to take a look at the allegations that we've presented here and find that this neighbor had pumped a known carcinogen onto these people's homes and properties for 15 years unfettered. And because of the fact that they get lucky enough that it's odorless and it's colorless, that there was still a chemical that was on their property that they did not consent to, that this company profited from in the process. So you have this contamination that has in fact appeared on these people's properties and it's there. And what you have is basically a scarlet letter that shows that emission and that blanketing of this community by this chemical has put that all those people who own what is probably their most valuable and prized possession with a scarlet letter on it, so that they have to disclose anytime that they go to put their house up for sale that they have in fact been in this community and that there are still testing. There's still things that are going on. No one's entirely sure what in fact the long-term consequences of what this company has done to the soil and the groundwater and whatnot. Coupled with the fact
The framing of your argument, Ms. Sheets, on this point seems to angle towards the concern that the district court appeared to be mindful of, which is allegations based upon the whole area, as opposed to a particular property of Mr. Sherrod. You're talking now in terms of all of the people in the community and so forth, without specifying the actual plaintiff at issue in the appeal. Disabuse me of my concern.
Okay. Well, I will tell you that if you look at the SBA report, they directly did look at Mr. Sherrod's property. They did an appraisal before the conduct, and then they determined that because of where his property was situated, that he did in fact have, I believe it was an 8.+% diminution in market value to his property, of which the defendant and the district court didn't think to seem too much of, given that it was, I think, just shy of $10,000, but it was nonetheless showing that Mr. Sherrod's property was valued less than it should have been, but for the defendant's contamination.
Can you address in this context the windfall argument inability to place in time the harm, especially if it may diminish?
I think I appreciate you bringing that up. That was something I did want to address. And Mr. Kappelman is in the tax context saying that here in the tort domain, that essentially you're talking about these amorphous dates that you can't sort of pinpoint when in fact the stigma attached. And what Mr. Anderson and his company did was in fact determine that market awareness based on the searches, based on their interviews with the realtors, attached the stigma actually happened here during that first community meeting when that area of concern map was blown up, was all over the news, and was widely reported in media articles and on neighborhood group websites throughout the community. They have pinpointed that precise event as to when market awareness of what was going on in this community attached. And therefore, Mr. Sherrod's damages started then, and they were able to say that it's still an ongoing issue through the date that they were accumulating and acquiring this information, which was June of 2021. Pardon me?
That's based on the first model, correct?
Yes, that's based on the first model. But what the SBA report also said is that even irrespective of the first model, the fact of the matter is that scarlet letter had attached to that community. Mr. Sherrod's property, that first area of concern, was during the height of the market awareness for the first year after this story hit the news. And everyone was aware of what was going on in his properties there. What we're saying is a year after the fact, for them to have modified the area, and he's now a tenth of a mile out of the area, does not suddenly give his property the all clear by any stretch of the imagination. Those damages are still ongoing to this day.
Counsel, would he still be required to disclose that since he's no longer in the area?
It is our belief that it would absolutely. I'm sorry, what was that?
Would he be required to disclose that as part of any sale of his property going forward since it's no longer in the area? Yes. Is really what I'm asking. Okay, and what do you base that on?
Yes, we base that on the fact that, again, that modeling that is existing is showing him up a tenth of the side of the area. And in fact, what that model and that information says is those numbers are minimal and that it likely extends out outside of that area in certain concentrations. We know that to be a fact. The state agency has affirmatively stated that repeatedly.
But to Judge Kirk's question, what basis in law is there in light of his property being outside the most recent study for Mr. Sherrod to have to make a disclosure in a purchase agreement?
Well, because again, Your Honor, I think what we view it as is first and foremost for that the time period and the duration of our claim here, for him to have been moved outside that tenth of a mile, we still believe that the data in the first area of concern is probably more relevant.
I understand. I understand that's what you're saying. You believe, and my question is, as a matter of law, whether it's contract law, property law, with regard to home sales, since that would be where any harm. What is the basis in law for your proposition that your client would now, going forward, be obligated to make a disclosure of contamination on this property?
And I do not specialize in this area of the law, Your Honor, the real estate law, but it's my understanding and our client's belief that if he goes forward and sells his home, that he's under an obligation based on the allegations made in his complaint and his own belief that he is in fact in the crosshairs of an environmental contamination site, that he would have to disclose that or otherwise puts himself at risk for, you know, should 2 years down the road, someone buys his house and the Minnesota agency comes out and says, oh, guess what? There is in fact groundwater contamination. Mr. Sherrod is not going to want to be on the hook for not having represented the truth in his seller's disclosure form.
Very well, thank you, Ms. Sheets. Your time has expired. I don't see any other questions. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions today in the briefing, and we will now take the matter under advisement. We will be issuing an order within 90 days. So we'll be proceeding to our second oral argument. You each have a good day. Thank you.
Thank you as well.